Well, I can truthfully say that I have had a marvelous ministry in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It has had its ups and downs, but the church has been good to me, to us. I've had the privilege of working in many different assignments in several different countries. I've been able to carry a number of responsibilities, and even today I still find my way within the church. And I think that that is just one illustration of the fact that the church actually can accommodate a lot of different people and a lot of different opinions. Sometimes people have asked me, when you go around and say so many different things and sometimes critical things, how can you still function in the church? But the marvelous thing is that you can. If you try to do so in a as pleasant a way as possible, as honest a way as possible, there may be lots of things that we find difficult to handle, but there's lots of space. There are some people, maybe not here in the Church of Grief, but in almost any church that I know of, that you find a bit difficult. Well, they're given to us to strengthen our character. But most people in the Seventh-day Adventist Church worldwide, in my experience, are very nice people. And in the end, there is quite a lot of tolerance for different viewpoints. And so the church has grown in a century and a half to where it is today. And yes, there may be unique challenges, but I think the church has so much going for it that somehow God will take care of its future.
You're optimistic, and we're looking forward, thank you very much, to your presentation this morning, The Divine Grand Story.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm certainly encouraged by the fact that so many people have turned out on a Sunday morning, 10 o'clock. Of course, it's 11 already. This morning we will try to bring some of the things together that we have been talking about and looking at over the past 2 days. And I start out with a couple of premises that built on what we said on Friday evening and yesterday. A large part of our audience today is thinking different when compared to the way people were thinking a generation or so ago. And we said, well, a large part of our audience, both outside and inside the church, is more or less postmodern. That's true for the people in the world. That's true for the people inside the Adventist community. Another thing that we have, I hoped, tried to underline is that Adventists in the past have been willing to change or to adjust their interpretations of Daniel and the Revelation. It's not like the full package fell out of heaven around 1840 or between 1840 and 1850, but we have continuously been shaping our understanding of what the prophecies of Daniel and the Revelation mean. And because we have that tradition, I believe it's legitimate to continue in that tradition. And not to say, well, what we read in the books by Uriah Smith, that's it. That must somehow be meaningful, all of it, for us today, but it's legitimate to look for further meaning, to look for additional interpretations that will help us to make past truth into present truth. So, we're going on those premises. Now, one of the things that postmodern people don't like, and mentioned that yesterday, is the idea of having a meta-narrative, or what is called a grand story. And what is meant is one particular view, one particular kind of a perspective, theory that explains everything. That is kind of an umbrella philosophy. One satisfying, coherent, grand story that is the basic explanation for everything we find around us and experience. But the postmodern conviction is no, such grand stories, such all-encompassing explanations do not exist. And if you insist that such an explanation, such a theory is existing, then usually you try to push it also on others, because it is the truth. And then, of course, often there is a significant amount of force, of violence even, and of controversy that erupts. And history is full of examples of what happens when one particular kind of philosophy, one particular kind of ideology is pushed on the people. And unfortunately, Christianity does not have such a good track record either. There are many instances where one particular Christian ideology has been pushed on the people as being the truth, the grand story. It has resulted in very sad conditions. So the postmodern person says, rather than having one grand story that explains everything, you have your own story. And if you're happy with that, that's all that counts. So that then means that such theories, such ideologies as Marxism, communism, yes, even Christianity, that's something of the past. We will have to be content with smaller stories and not theories that everybody will have to accept as true. Now, to some extent, this sounds reasonable. But there is a major weakness. And you often find that when you're looking at particular new philosophical ideas. Often philosophical ideas are based on a premise that is invalid. Now, let me give an example. There was a very important philosophical current in the past that said only those things are true which can be experienced by sense perception. So only things that you can hear, see, feel, taste, touch are true. Empiricism. Only what you can experience. That rule itself, can you taste it? Can you touch it? Feel it? See it? So, by saying that, that very rule does not fit into the theory you are proposing. When you say these all-embracive statements that cover everything, they must be done away with. That in itself is making an all-embracive statement. So, by its very nature, you are entitled to doubt that. And we may ask the question, yes, many of these theories, Many of these ideologies, many of these all-encompassing perspectives have failed. But is that really proof that no all-embracing perspective can be valid? I don't think that follows logically from the first statement. So let's keep our minds open, and maybe there is a place still for something that is a wider perspective under which, if not everything, most things that we experience will fit. Is there really no meta-narrative, no ideology, no theory that will cover everything? Now, I believe, and that is really what we have been working towards, that Daniel and the Revelation, if read in a particular way, can provide such a convincing grand story, can provide a unique perspective on history, on life, and that in itself, I believe, is present truth. That is not something that would apply to those in the past, that people in the past were happy with, but that is something we can be happy with. Yes, many of these grand stories have failed, but here the Bible presents something that may yet prove to be such a perspective that explains what we are and why we are here. Now, when we look at perspectives, the way of looking at events, the way of looking at history. History is not just a cold series of historical facts. In fact, just knowing some dates and knowing some events doesn't tell you much about what really happened. What makes a date, what makes an event important? On November the 22nd, 1963, most of us knew where we were when we heard that JF Kennedy had been assassinated. That was on that particular fateful day. I remember I was studying at Newbold when the news came that the President of the United States had been killed. Now, that very same day, C.S. Lewis, the great British writer, so well known around the world, he died. Now, for us, probably that date is significant, mostly because of the death of Kennedy. But what about the relatives of C.S. Lewis? They will not remember that date because Kennedy died, but they will remember that date for a very different reason. One of their loved ones died on that very day. 1942. You know, that's the year that Muhammad Ali was born. It's also the year in which Barbara Streisand was born. Lots of good people born that year. You were born that year. You see? You were born that year. All right. Okay, so I have a guess how old you are. You know, well, when you think of 1942, you don't think of Muhammad Ali, do you? No. But there are more people who would think of 1942 as the year of birth of Muhammad Ali than the year in which I was born, or you were born, or you were born. Yet for me, 1942 is significant because of this personal role that year plays in my personal history. Why is the 22nd of December 1942 important? 64, okay. Why is that important? Well, I tell you, in the Netherlands, in one particular village in the southern part of the country, a company to celebrate Carnival was organized. Do I remember that date because that happened? No, that's only because I found it on the internet. But that was the date that the 22nd of December, each year I should not forget. Because if I do, I'm in trouble. So particular dates have particular significance, particular things we see from a particular perspective. History is, our own personal history, it's all about perspective. You heard of the English Wars? Now, see, when we lived in Britain for a number of years, I decided to read a little bit more about British history. Because after all, if you live here, and we lived here for
7 years,
yes. You know, you want to know a little bit more about the country where you're in. And to my surprise, they spoke about the Dutch Wars. In Holland, we speak about the English Wars. Same events. I thought from what I had learned at the elementary school that we had done quite well in those wars against the British. In fact, we won them all. Very, very clearly. Now, when I read the history books that I bought here, that gave a different perspective on those wars. It was admitted that we had a bit of luck once in a while, but really, you know, we were no match for the British. So, 1492, what happened? Yes. So that was a landmark in the history of civilization, right? Well, ask the Indians, ask the native population on the other side of the ocean, whether they have the same perspective on the travels of Columbus. Same event, but a very different kind of evaluation, a very kind of different perspectives. There are so many examples. The Crusades. In history, in Christian history, well, it's beginning to change, but for a long time, you know, this was something that was actually quite a positive thing, that there something was done against the ever-encroaching influence of the Turks. But in Muslim history, you know, the Crusades are still very much alive. For many people in Muslim countries, it's as if it happened yesterday. And you know, it is difficult to believe that there are some not very well-informed Christian missionaries who go and have evangelistic campaigns in Muslim environments, which they call crusades. Evangelistic crusades. And that's a term that in many environments today is not a term to use. Crusades are looked upon very differently depending on your perspective. So then, how do we look at history? many different philosophies of history. Some say history is a series of random events. There's no real pattern. Others see a kind of evolutionary development of mankind. Others see some cyclic pattern. Things happen, the same kind of things continue to happen. What has been comes around again. There was the Marxist view of history. Everything must be explained in terms of the power struggle between the different social classes. And then, of course, there is a traditional Christian point of view. A linear history can be compared with a line that begin when God created, that ends when God recreates, and at a crucial point there is the coming of Jesus Christ, and everything before Christ is BC and everything after Christ is AD, even though the BBC doesn't allow us to call it that anymore. Now, the Adventist view of history is to a large extent based on this traditional Christian view, linear view of history, but as we discussed yesterday, it can be summarized by the term the Great Controversy. That is one particular way of looking at history. History of the world, history actually of everything, including ourselves. So when we read the Bible, we should always keep in mind, and of course there are lots of things that we could be discussing with regard to that particular point, but when we are reading the Bible, even the historical books of the Bible, we are not just reading ordinary history. Every history book has a certain perspective on history. Like the British books have a certain perspective on those clashes with the Dutch. And the Dutch have a particular view with regard to those same events. Two different perspectives. The Bible also has its own perspective. The Bible has God's perspective. And history is first of all seen as salvation history. History in the Bible is not just political events that somehow were important and must be mentioned. No, but if historical events are mentioned, it is in connection with the overarching theme of salvation history. And so you probably have noticed when you read in the books of Kings and Chronicles, you read the history of the kings of first the United Kingdom and then, well, the United Kingdom. Probably that term has a dual meaning here in this country, but okay, when you read about Israel, the 12 tribes, and then about Judah, the 2, and Israel, the 10 tribes. Many kings who were quite important, actually, when you look at their actions, the wars that they did, that they had, but they only merit a short piece of text. There are other kings that may not have been so important politically, but they get much more space. But it seems that the overall perspective is, hey, King X did what was good in the eyes of the Lord. King Y, he did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. That was the determinative factor for the perspective in which that history is being viewed and is being recorded. Now, reading the books of Daniel and Revelation, may, I believe, provide us with a bird's eye view of God's perspective. when we read those books, we shall not be looking for precise political events. That's not the main thing. The main thing is trying to discover this wider perspective. And I believe that you cannot escape the conclusion when you read those two books that we are being told, listen, God is in control. And there is something beyond the bare facts, something beyond the things that happen here to us, to the people of this world. There is a cosmic dimension. There is this great controversy dimension. That's God's perspective. So now, if we read then the books of Daniel and the Revelation with that particular aspect in mind, let's remember when we start reading that if we're postmodern people, and most of us are to some extent, and many in our community are, then we are not or no longer interested in a purely rational approach. Finding out what symbol A means, finding out what symbol B means, finding out what historical event might be referred to, something that we can check with history books, something that is quite cerebral. But let's remember that Daniel and the Revelation is not a ordinary history book. It's not like reading the newspaper. It's apocalyptic literature. Now, if you read a collection of poems, you read much differently than from when you're reading Times, or what is it, the Daily Telegraph. I remember I always have to be careful mentioning newspapers, because in Britain people are very keen on reading particular papers and avoiding other papers, is it not, John? Yeah, I learned a few things from John. We need to read the Sun, isn't it? The Daily Mail, okay. But reading Daniel in Revelation is more like reading poetry than reading the Daily Mail. It's a particularly literary style. But it's not quite like reading poetry. It's a particular genre that was very much used in the intertestamental period, just before Jesus Christ, and this applies in particular to the book of Revelation and in the time of Jesus Christ. And it was not meant to be read as history, but it was read as a source, it was intended to be a source of spiritual encouragement in times of difficulty and trouble. It was written not only for us to understand, or for the people to understand, but for the people to experience. And that strikes a chord with postmodern people, because we postmoderns, we like not only to understand, but we like to experience. And we feel there is more to knowing than just having the facts. So how do we experience Daniel and the Revelation? Now, just to underline this, if we want to catch this broader picture, if we want to experience this perspective of God in Daniel and the Revelation, then I would suggest that we no longer study the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. Let's do away with studying. Let's start reading. No, we always talk Seventh-day Adventists. That's our traditional approach. We study. And by that, we often mean that we take a bit here and we take a bit there and then we combine it. But let's start with just reading. And reading the whole of the book, if possible in one session. That, by the way, is how most people who have never read the Bible today will begin reading. They will not be interested in you picking a verse here and picking a verse there and then combining in that and say, well, you see, this is what it means. But people will want to start reading the Bible for themselves. And you have to let them do that. Without telling them all the time, but you see, this is what it means. Because even if they come to different conclusions, they want to have the chance to draw their own conclusions. And then maybe they'll discuss it with you later. They don't want to be manipulated by you telling them what they should find. They should read. And we must believe that if this is God's word, if this is inspired by God, then that same spirit who inspired the authors will also inspire the readers. And in fact, we see proof of that all the time that that happens. That people will somehow, when they keep on reading, begin to understand the penny begins to drop. So, Daniel and the Revelation, I firmly believe, is first of all a matter of reading. Continue to read, read and reread in one particular session. Most Seventh-day Adventists have never read the entire book of Revelation in one session. I'm not going to ask you whether you have or not. But if you haven't, then try. Not once, but maybe 5 times or 10 times. Don't worry if you don't understand what the 7 thunders mean. Don't worry if you wonder what a 5th trumpet might mean. Just keep on reading. And then see what overall experience the reading of that book gives you. Try to use all your senses and then see what it does to you. Now that may be a bit of a different approach to Daniel and the Revelation, but that is more of a postmodern approach. And since most of us are somewhat postmodern, I would suggest that you try it. You ever seen this picture? This was painted by Van Gogh. Now, Van Gogh is a very interesting fellow. Right now, there is a lot of discussion because it has always been assumed that he committed suicide. But just a couple of weeks ago, there has been a scholarly publication arguing for the fact that he was actually murdered. But that's not the point here. You know, when you look at this picture, then, let me see. How many of you have seen how many potatoes there are on the plate? Did you count the potatoes?
Couldn't see them.
Couldn't see them. Oh, they were there. If you studied good enough, they were there. You know, actually, what did you see? You saw people. What struck you?
Their faces.
What did the picture express?
Questions.
questions? Yes.
Sadness.
Yes.
Comments.
Yes.
Struggle.
Struggle.
Struggling.
Yes. So there is a particular way you look at this picture, isn't it? You're not looking just at the facts. You're not looking at all the details of what, you know, there is in the room, etc., etc. But there is an overall message that the picture gives you. These people are poor. This is a hard life. And so, that is how you see this. Have you ever seen this picture? It's a very well-known Norwegian picture. It was stolen, I think, a few years ago, and fortunately it was returned again. The scream. When I first saw that, I almost heard the picture. You know, somehow, the fact that this fellow is screaming is so clear. It is heart-wrenching. That is the overall message that the picture have. Now, you could try many pictures. Here you have a picture of Monet. Summer. Doesn't that strike you as extremely pleasant? Tranquility, yes. So, I would suggest that we try to experience the revelation in a somewhat similar way. That we read it, reread it, and see what it does to us. What is the overall message that we gain from it? Well, most people, when they read the Revelation, the Revelation, this is, and if they don't know what all these symbols mean, this is what they get out of it. There is an all-out spiritual war going on. It's a fight about something vital, about something important. And it's almost like a multimedia show. You know, you have sounds, you have lightnings, thunders. There's all kinds of angelic beings flying all over the place. Then you have dragons and strange beasts and demons. You know, something is going on here. And it's about something that is important. It has an urgency. But at the same time, it is also clear that in the end, the good things win. That is what most people, that is the picture that most people gain when they read the Revelation and try to experience the message of the Revelation. Now, isn't in fact that the most important thing to be gained from the Revelation? That there is an enormous spiritual struggle going on, but that in the end, the good will win. I would suggest that when you try to experience the Revelation, that if you read and reread, you will be overwhelmed by the message. God is in control is something that will jump at you in the book of Daniel. Even if you don't understand all the symbols, but that's clear. God is in control. And that's just as clear in the Revelation. There is a focus. In the book of Daniel, there are many different kingdoms, many different powers. But in the end, it is the divine kingdom that will be established. Now, even if you don't know about Babylon and Medo-Persia and Greece and all the rest of it, isn't that the most important message to be gained from it? That after all the different earthly powers have had their say, God will have the final word. One Adventist author, Roy Naden, about 30 years ago, wrote this marvelous book, The Lamb Among the Beasts. And he said in his book, we have written so much about those beasts, and we have almost forgotten the Lamb. There's a South African author who wrote a book on the Revelation. He entitled it The Eclipse of Christ in the Revelation. In other words, he was also concerned that in all our talking, in all our writing about the Reformation, we didn't see Christ anymore. How does the Revelation start? It's a revelation of Jesus Christ, isn't it? And so let's never forget it. That is the kernel, and that is the experience that we must have. What is the most important part of the book of Revelation? Which are the most beautiful chapters? 14, the end, 21 and 22. Any other takers? Four? Why four? Well, we have talked a little bit these past few days, and we haven't agreed on everything. But here, did I bring a Bible today? But oh, I give my Bible to you. Have my Bible. You know, when you read in those chapters 4 and 5, then you see that there is a scroll that is sealed. There is something important. Even if you can't explain what it is, there's something very important happening here. And it seems that unless that scroll can be opened, there is deep trouble. And so the question is, who can open? Nobody, nothing. And John knows somehow what is meant. So he weeps. He knows this is terrible, that the scroll cannot be opened. And then there is a voice that says, well, wait a minute, there is someone. It's the Lamb, Jesus Christ. He can open. Now, even if you don't know what the seals are, even if you don't know what it means, the opening of the seals and everything that goes with it, isn't the message quite clear? There's trouble. There's no solution unless we recognize the Lamb. And then the Lamb comes forward, and then what happens? A detailed theological analysis of what was happening, is that what we find? What do we find? Chapter 5. Worship. There is an explosion of thanksgiving. First, the heavenly beings around the throne. And then you see that all the angels join in. And then eventually, the whole universe explodes in thanksgiving. That's the gospel. So even if you don't understand exactly the meaning of all the seals and every detail that goes with it, this you can understand, this you can experience. And I would suggest if you keep reading, you will almost hear the thanksgiving. You will hear this enormous choir that bursts forth. So that is the focus. And sure, I'm with you. Revelation 21 and 22, of course, is an extension of that. When eventually what the Lamb was able to do will be fully accomplished and will be fully realized. And, you know, if you want to say that those are the most important chapters, fine. But what I just wanted to emphasize is that by just reading it, by just letting it overwhelm you, you can catch the most important aspects of these terribly important books. Be overwhelmed while reading by the message. Somehow, even if you don't understand all the symbols, you realize God is at work behind the scenes. Do you understand Daniel 10? It's a strange chapter. There, Daniel is troubled, and he gets a visit from an heavenly being, and that heavenly being says to Daniel, "Now wait a minute, you know, I wished I could have come earlier, but I had to make a visit. I had to see the prince of Greece, and then I had to see the prince of the Medes and the Persians." You remember that? Daniel 10. What do you make of that? I don't know. It is strange, isn't it? But do you get a sense that, hey, there is more going on than we realize? You know, somehow, behind the scenes, God is at work. Well, I think that's all we need to know. Even if you can't exactly interpret, if you can, so much more power to you, but even if you can't, this is the message that you get. God is at work. It's greater than what we experience on this world. There was war in heaven, Revelation 12. Do you understand that? How could there be war in heaven? How could that start? How could sin erupt in a place that was sinless? You know, I don't think any of us have any final answer to that kind of question. But what it does make clear is, you know, don't try to think that everything you see here, that you experience, that's the whole picture. No, it isn't. So before you come to any rash conclusions, just remember, there is more than you can see. There is more between heaven and earth than you can experience. God is at work behind the scenes. You know, you may not understand everything, but this you can understand. Evil will be totally defeated. It's clear who wins. There's no doubt about it. Lots of trouble, lots of war, lots of strife, battle, you name it. But Christ is victorious, and evil will be defeated. And you see, that is the overall message that we can experience. And in the second section this morning, I will look at a number of details. But I would suggest this morning to you that even though the postmodern people say there is no grand narrative, no overarching perspective from which to understand everything, I believe there is actually. There is a satisfying way of looking at the world. That's a divine perspective. The great grand story that I happen to believe in. And that is the great controversy. And I use that word a little bit advisedly because, you know, now there's a lot of discussion about the great controversy and the book. Should we distribute it by the millions as we are planning to do, or should we be a little bit more careful considering some of the content of the book, etc., etc.? I'm not speaking of that. I'm speaking of the concept of the great controversy between Christ and Satan, which began somewhere, somehow, in heaven, We can't understand it, but what we do realize while reading, it's always in the background. But it does not continue. It will end in an earth made new. And there it is. In the book of Daniel, even more clearly in the book of Revelation, you might say it's a tale of two cities. There's Jerusalem, there's Babylon. And Jerusalem stands for everything that's on the side of God, and Babylon stands for everything that's against God. Now, where are you? What are you choosing? That is the message of the book of Revelation. That is what a postmodern person can understand when he experiences after he has read or while he is reading. And this grand story, somehow your story is part of it, because you have to make a choice. It's about your loyalty to one or to the other. So Daniel and the Revelation, I believe these two Bible books reveal the true meaning of the history of the world. They reveal the true meaning of my own history. And that is present truth. And that's why it was present truth in the time of Daniel, in the time of John the Revelator, and all through history, and why that can be present truth for you and me as more or less postmodern people. So let's just take a little break now, and then we take a couple of concepts more in depth to explore how the message of those two Bible books can appeal to us as postmoderns.
Sure. You were talking of some of the results of postmodern thinking in the Adventist Church, and one you mentioned was that some of our scholars are putting a second century BC date for Daniel, and I'm just wondering how well this is accepted and what the consequences are, because from what I've realized, that the book of Daniel, the authorship was doubted even from the second century, and the last two centuries it was doubted. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a number of the critics think that it was an anonymous writer of Daniel, not Daniel. Mm-hmm. Those who believe it think it's an anonymous writer, or do they think it was Daniel? And the reason that it was put as a later time was because it has predictive elements, and some of the critics do not accept prophetic future. And because it seemed to be indicating Antiochus' epiphanies, a prediction, then they thought that it must have been written afterwards. Mm-hmm. They think that prophecy is only written after its event. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They also thought that there were historical inaccuracies in Daniel. For example, Daniel talks about Nebuchadnezzar being the great builder. Mm-hmm. But interesting, in the second century, it was Queen Semiramis the Greeks mm-hmm. thought was the builder. Mm-hmm. So how would Daniel have known if he'd lived that late? So are there these Adventist scholars believe that there is no predictive element in Daniel and would not accept that, and accept mm-hmm. that prophecy is written after the event? Because, you know, it would take away the whole of this idea of the future and the great prediction.
My answer would be that these questions are not unimportant, but I think it's important to first of all shift the focus, because most postmodern people couldn't care less as to whether Daniel was written 6th century BC or 2nd century BC. Most postmodern people want to know what's in it for me. What kind of message does it have? So, and I would suggest it's legitimate to prioritize that particular question, because that is the question our audience is asking. That's the question very many Adventists are asking today. You know, there's one group of Adventists that that says, tell us about these more technical details. There is a large and growing number of Adventists who couldn't give a hoot. But they ask themselves now, okay, when I read it, what does it do for me? So I would suggest that that is legitimate to first of all focus on that. Now, we haven't spoken this morning about some of the critical concerns, but I have suggested read, reread, see what you get out of it. Now, that does not mean that these questions go away. And many people will at some stage also want to know about that. Now, the question of the dating of Daniel, most of the objections to a 6th century date can be answered. There are linguistic arguments and there are historical elements there, and most of the issues have been answered quite successfully. There are admittedly quite a few difficulties when you look at Daniel 11. Now, there is a school of thought, and I tend to more or less agree with that, to say that the book of Daniel was written by Daniel in the 6th century BC, but it may well be that later on, for instance in the 2nd century, there were some additions, and that maybe some parts are of a little later origin. You know, the Bible has had a very complicated history. Part of it we cannot trace, or most of it we cannot trace. But the Bible somehow established itself as being the Word of God. And independent of whether you have this, that, or another view of some of the history of some parts of the Bible speaks with authority as no other book does. And so I think we should worry a little less about some of these technical details. Let's emphasize first the message that we can get out of it. But if you ask me, is it 6th century or 2nd century BC? I would say I'm fairly sure that most of it is 6th century BC. I'm not so sure whether there are not some later editorial additions that maybe account for some of the difficulties for which we have no answers yet. But then we make discoveries all the time, and sometimes, you know, new discoveries suddenly reveal that even those difficulties can be solved in a different way. Is that somewhat satisfactory?
Yes, I think as long as we have a belief that Daniel did write it,
sure,
we can accept it. If we go with the critics who said it was anonymous, then you can't have the confidence in Daniel. So I think we need to know, be sure that it was Daniel that wrote.
Okay.
And then we can accept the overall, mm-hmm, overall predictions.
I'd just like to share an experience of my own, if I may, regarding your suggestion to read through. It was many years ago. I'd finished my day's work. I was living in the north of England, and I drove up the side of a hillside where there was a fantastic view, and my plan was to go for a walk before the sun went down. But when I got to this particular car park, the wind was howling, the sky was grey and threatening, and I thought, oh, I really don't want to go out and get wet and cold. And I happened to turn on the radio, Radio 4. I hadn't planned to do this, but there was a broadcast of a reader who was reading the book of Revelation. I think it was about an hour, and I got into it after the first few minutes. And I sat looking over the North Lancashire countryside with a storm coming in and a red sky as the sun was going down, and listening to the words of Revelation coming over the radio with this fantastic panorama, made a huge impact on me as this, can I say, story being made live literally in front of my eyes. Mm-hmm. And I have never forgotten that experience.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that, because that's a good illustration as to how experiences can portray truth in a very existential and fundamental way that even just plain words cannot match.
Could I just ask a brief question that you might be answering in the next session? And that is, as Adventists, many of us have become Seventh-day Adventists because of a particular interpretation of Daniel and Revelation. We see ourselves as having a particular message for a particular time, this time in which we're living. And to take a more postmodern approach to the book of Daniel and Revelation, kind of, for some people, might be seen as undermining our reason for existence. And I'm wondering whether you will be having an opportunity to respond to that later, or whether you want to
mention that now. Let me try to do so briefly now before we forget. We all come to our Adventist experience in different ways. As people throughout history have come to Christianity in different ways. When we read in the past of the way in which some people have experienced conversion, you know, there are some very famous and moving conversion stories. Most of us have not had that kind of an experience, because it seemed, at least to me, it seemed that in the more modern period, we would not trust even such experiences, because we would have to be convinced by arguments. Now, it's interesting, for instance, that today, when Muslims become Christian, I don't know whether you have noticed, but almost always a Muslim will tell you, if he became a Christian, that he had a dream. And that is so significant. Now, most of us, you know, if we would tell each other, look, I had a dream last night, and this is, then we would say, well, use fewer spices when you have your supper, you know, because then you won't be troubled by these things. So, because we distrust these experiences. But by the way, postmodern people do so to a far lesser extent. And that's why maybe also the idea that you have visions and dreams in Daniel and the Revelation may not be sound so strange to them. But if people came to accept the Seventh-day Adventist message by this particular road, I wouldn't want to discredit that at all. I'm only suggesting that most people now have a different mindset. And when we want to have them also benefit from the message of these Bible books, then we ask ourselves the question, is it legitimate to say, now before we worry about the exact meaning of the seven seals, try at least whether you can get the essential message. And then, and I think that is actually practice, when people do eventually become Christians or do become Seventh-day Adventists, yes, at some point they will want to know what these seals mean, and they will want to know the deeper significance of some of these symbols. But I think we also have to recognize that actually there is a lot of intellectual maneuvering about the meaning of these symbols, a lot of controversy even, that has engendered a lot of heat but little light. And so I would suggest that in the end it is more important that we catch the meaning of the Lamb in the book of Revelation, of the Son of God in the book of Daniel, than knowing all the details of all the symbols. But no, I'm not suggesting to people who have come into Seventh-day Adventist to kind of deny the validity of that experience, or to feel that is being downplayed. The only thing is to say, try to recognize that this was in a particular setting, in a particular time. Now there are lots of people who have a different mindset, who approach it differently, and we also want them to know the Book of Revelation and, you know, to catch what is in there for them. So it is additional, but for some people it is prior. That's somehow. All right.
Should we have a break? Should we come back about 11:30? And
that'll give us a good 20-minute break then, all right? Thank you.